everybody. This is Connie Morgan with the Free Black Thought Podcast. Today's guest is Charles Jacobs. He is the president of the American Anti-Slavery Group, and in 2000, he received Boston's Freedom Award from Coretta Scott King for his work in helping to liberate thousands of black slaves in Sudan. He wrote a piece called Arab Enslavement and Slaughter of Black Africans Must Stop for Tablet Magazine at the end of 2023. In this episode, Charles talks about his evolution from Marxist organizer to a more traditional value-centered worldview. He shares shocking stories of modern-day slavery and the seeming lack of interest in talking about oppressor versus oppressed dynamics that are not conducive to a certain narrative being pushed today. In my opinion, this is one of the most important episodes we have done to date, and it will help you become more informed when you have conversations about slavery. Because remember, there is no such thing as the black perspective, just black people.
You're listening to the Free Black Thought Podcast.
Charles, thank you so much for joining me here today on the Free Black Thought Podcast. We are so excited to have you on, and I think this is just going to be a very enlightening episode for a lot of our listeners, and I just know we're going to get tons of great feedback, and I can't wait to get into all the amazing things you're doing, particularly around trying to free slaves. I mean, and it's crazy to say that in 2024 that there's still a need for it, and we're going to unpack all of it. But first, can you please tell our audience a little bit about yourself, how you were raised, where you grew up, how you kind of got into Sure. this line of work?
Sure. It's a pleasure to meet you and to be on the show. I am a Jewish guy. I was born in Newark, New Jersey, way back, maybe the last white guy at a Newark. It was a tough neighborhood. And I was born to two Jewish parents who didn't know much about their Judaism. And so we were kind of pagan animists. I don't know what we were, seculars for the longest time. And like many people like that, I was a man of the left. Mm-hmm. I joined the NAACP in college. For us, the black struggle was a reflection of what had happened to my people. And so it was a blessing and a duty to be on that side. And I recall arguments with people, even in my family, who were racist. And I remember my dad walking out of a room when somebody said the N-word, and I was very Wow. proud of him. I eventually went to my mom had a union friend who was going to go to Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. And he took me along, and I was there. Wow. And if you played that speech for me on tape, which it exists, I will definitely 100% tear up again, because it was so deep. And then I went to college and became a real leftist. And I belonged to SDS, Students for Democratic Society, and I was a protester against the war in Vietnam. And eventually I became very, very far left. And I mean, I'm like, I would pound my chest right now for how far left I had gone before. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. And then I decided they were wrong. And I kind of turned back the other way. Meanwhile,
did you have a red pill moment, or as they say today, like what was it that made you pivot?
Yes, I had a red pill moment. I did. I mean, I had learned to speak Spanish because I went to Spain in my junior year abroad with a Spanish friend, and eventually I got a job as a tour guide in Mexico and Acapulco when it was wonderful. It's now not so wonderful, and I spoke Spanish, and I was. As a leftist, I was leading rent strikes in Cambridge, Massachusetts, in Central Square, in Spanish, because there was a Spanish-speaking neighborhood and the rents were shooting up, and I was going to help the people there. And, you know, I did that. But eventually, I remember my red pill moment was the communists that I were hanging around with were telling me, well, you know, in Israel, what's going to happen is that the Jewish working class and the Arab working class are going to unite to kick out the British imperialists. And I said to myself, that ain't going to happen. You're out of your mind. Are you kidding me? The Jews need a homeland, and they're not doing this to have a worldwide revolution, and you're nuts. And then the left really turned against Israel, and I said, how could you do that? We're supposed to be for we're supposed to be for the downtrodden, the minorities, the threatened, the victimized. And look what happened to us. And now we're starting a little tiny country in the midst of millions of people who want to kill us. And you're going to join the millions of people who want to kill us because you're a left. I mean, it makes no sense. So I went 180, I mean, not 180, but I still maintained all of my good, I would say, social welfare. You know, I'm very upset about income inequality. I'm very upset about working class people who don't get a fair shake. So I'm still on that side of that. But as far as worldview, the left just made me crazy and I left.
When you were hanging out with all the communists, did you consider yourself a communist at the time?
I was about to join the Progressive Labor Party. Oh my God, I haven't said that to anybody. No, those guys were to the left of Stalin. I mean, those guys were Maoists. Mm-hmm. But I never quite joined them. But I would have said I was a socialist. I wouldn't have said probably I was a communist.
Okay.
So I understood the whole world through those lenses. And I understand how the kids today can see it because it's a total package. It explains everything. Everything in the world that you might be confused about or might be curious about, you can lay it to the class analysis and that's it, you know? Mm-hmm. So, and it's a simplification of the complex world, and it's evil because it treats people as classes instead of individuals, mm-hmm. which is what we have much of today.
Okay. So as you were shifting away from the commies, heck off, commie. And you clearly have a heart for humans, right? But now you're it's not like your priority has changed. You still want to help humankind, but now you're like, I'm probably not viewing these problems with the correct lens. Did you immediately kind of land into a new philosophical home, or were you just sort of wandering in the desert for a while?
No, I was kind of wandering in the desert. I got closer and closer to my Judaism and Jewishness. Because of that experience and because I was learning about the Holocaust. I went to Harvard University at some point and I tried to join a congregation, which is, I had never really done that before. And the rabbi, I'll never forget this, he's a brilliant guy. He said to me, you know, there's a lot of lefty Jews who were turning away from that and coming to us. And you know your problem, you guys? You know more about the Nazis than about the Jews. You know, you come here because you're responding to the Holocaust, right? Mm-hmm. You know more about Eichmann than you know about Moses. You got to learn about Moses. So that's interesting. And I eventually began to do that. Later, I eventually began to do that. So no, I was kind of wandering around. I got as a young man, I got jobs as tour guide in Mexico and Spain. I was having a good time. Then I finally graduated, got a job as a management consultant, made a bunch of money, got very lucky and invested in a couple of small pieces of property in real estate. And then I started to find out that Israel was being blasted in the press. For reasons that I thought were ridiculous. And I got worried about that. I thought it could lead to a kind of a new kind of anti-Semitism. And I also learned almost at the same time that I was on a plane. I was going to a management consulting gig and I was reading a magazine. In those days, there weren't, you know, people didn't have their tablets and people didn't have their phones. They were actually carts of magazines that the stewardesses would go up and down the aisle. Mm-hmm. And I said, let me have The Economist. I opened The Economist. And on page 42, I learned that you could buy and sell black women for $15 in certain places on there. And I said, what? How can that be? How can that have? You know what?
This was just an article about it, or literally
the article. Just an article about it, but it was on page 42. So I said to myself, first of all, there were two shocks. How in the world could it happen that you can buy and sell people? You buy and sell black people for $15 or for any amount of money. But even more crazy was, why was this on page 42?
Mm-hmm. You know, right.
How did this happen? This happened on my watch, mm-hmm. right? Our watch.
Right.
It was happening. and you're not telling us about it on page 42, and it's happening a lot, and it's the first time I ever saw it, and it's on page 42. So I started to do research about this. I went to Amnesty International, and I found out that they had a lot of stuff in their back files about slavery in Sudan and Mauritania, two African, North African countries, but they weren't organizing against it. They weren't trying to free the slaves. They weren't trying to get marches, you know, to free the slave. And I thought, that's ridiculous. So I finally found somebody who was a Mauritanian Muslim. And in, and I'll get into this later, but Muslims in Mauritania, black Muslims, are enslaved by Arab Berbers. And this is, I mean, you would never find this out anywhere unless you dug deeply, deeply, deeply. So there's hundreds of thousands of black Muslim slaves. And I found out one of the leaders of the liberation movement happened to be a refugee in New York City. His name is Mohamed Atiyeh. And he and I wrote an article that we got into the New York Times. My goodness. And it was called Bought and Sold. And it explained how in Mauritania, Arabs who had started from Saudi Arabia and conquered all of North Africa in a kind of a jihadist movement and had converted many of the black Africans to Islam, probably forcibly converted, had enslaved hundreds of thousands of them. And that's the way it was. And in Mauritania, even today, as I'm, as you and I are speaking, even today, there are a couple of hundred thousand black Muslim slaves serving Arabo-Berber masters who don't think they're Muslim enough and who are racist against blacks. Okay, all everything I'm telling you, anybody could Google it; they'll find it out to be true. You can go on my website; I'll give it to you later. It's all true. It's all true. So Mohamed Atiyeh and I made a big splash with that New York Times op-ed. And it was a black friend of mine who helped me get it into the New York Times. And she was outraged at the news that this was happening. And we got it. And once it got into the New York Times, people started to demand that we write books about it, that we start a movement about it, that we do other things about it. And here I was, a management consultant, and you know, it was like I was doing this part time. And then the other part of the story was what was happening in Africa's largest country, which is Sudan, where the Arab Muslim North had declared a holy war. Nobody knew about jihad in those days. Nobody knew any of this stuff, you know, Islamic extremism. But they had declared a jihad against the black Christian South. And they had killed 2 or 3 million people and enslaved tens of thousands in slave raids. Arab militia armed by the government of Khartoum would storm African villages, shoot the men, take the women and children. They didn't need the men for the kind of slavery they wanted because it wasn't, they didn't need musculature. It wasn't tobacco crops, plantations or rice plantations. Cotton plantations. It was to humiliate the enemy and to steal the womb of the victim so that they could propagate themselves through the womb of the black slave women. So, you know, somebody once said I should call this the great sperm heist, but I, you know, it's that's exactly what it was. That's what it was. So I as an old organizer, right? I remember I organized I mean, all the good organizers came from the left, okay? So I went to New York and I found the diaspora elements, communities of the Mauritanians. In New York, you could, if Africa had 150,000 tribes, every one of them would have one restaurant in New York, right? So there were Mauritanians in New York and there were Southern Sudanese Christians in New York. And I went and I met them. I made it my business to meet them. And I met a guy that you should have on your program called Simon Dang. He's Sudanese. And I put them together. And here are these Mauritanian Muslims, right? And these Southern Sudanese Christians both of whom are victims of what we would now call jihad, they called holy war, right? Mm-hmm. And we started this little movement, and I created the American Anti-Slavery Group, mm-hmm. which has a website, iabolish.org, where everything I'm saying now can be seen. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we set up that group, and the Sudanese in New York, I said, you this is like a Holocaust. You have 2 million people killed and tens of thousands enslaved, maybe hundreds of thousands enslaved, and no one's helping you. And they said, well, we knocked on church doors and they say nice things to us. We go to Amnesty International.
When you say they knock on church doors, you mean in America? They go to churches
in America.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. They went to the New York churches in America. They went to Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, all the big human rights groups. And, you know, they would write articles about it maybe once in a while, put it in the back of their files, and that would be the end of it. And I thought that what I could do is I could rekindle the anti-apartheid movement. I mean, apartheid in South Africa is awful. I mean, it's just awful. But slavery in North Africa is even worse.
Right.
Right? You'd rather be an apartheided black in South Africa than a slave in North Africa.
Right.
So I thought all I would have to do is to keep writing articles and organizing with my Sudanese and Mauritanian compatriots. And the human rights community would come rushing to us and help. And the black leadership would come mm-hmm. rushing to us and help. And guess what, Connie? Didn't happen.
Were you able to still publish articles regularly? And then people would say, wow, that's awful. And then no one wanted to do anything about it. So you were still getting able to get published.
You know who did anything? I was able to publish articles. I even in the Boston Globe published me all the time. It praised me in its editorials. Mm-hmm. We got on Tony Brown's, this was a long time ago before you were born, I'm sure. Tony Brown was a black newscaster on NPR, was it? I forget what it was. And he was like the only national black news guy. And he had me and Muhammad Atiyeh tell our story mm-hmm. about Mauritanian slaves. And the thing that got him most crazy was when we described what Human Rights Watch did document as the tortures of uppity black slaves. Uppity, that's what they would say in America. So if you're a black slave in Mauritania, you can't touch the Quran, even though you're a Muslim, because mm-hmm. your hands are black. Mm-hmm. You can't marry somebody without your master's permission. And when your master dies, you get handed down through his estate as though you're a piece of furniture. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if your master has a friend who needs somebody to do extra work, he lends you to do his work, mm-hmm. or he gives you away as a wedding gift.
Right. You're a piece of furniture. Chattel. Your chair.
You're a piece of furniture. Okay. If God forbid you flinched, or you broke a teacup, or you lost a goat, or you were uppity, or you in some way showed him you weren't happy. There were three, you can find this in Human Rights Watch, three tortures that, I mean, you have to have a little bit of a stomach here. You ready?
I'm ready.
So one was called burning coals. They would take a slave out into the desert, dig a hole waist deep, stick him in it, but put hot coals near his genitals. and that we call one of them. The second was called the insect treatment, which was they would take these little desert insects, stick them into your ear, put stones on them, and then wrap your head around. And those people became mad. They became crazed. They were just crazed.
Of course, yeah.
And then there was the camel treatment, which is they would not let a camel, they would deprive it of drinking for, I don't know, camels have weeks, where his stomach shrunk. And then they would tie the punished slave to his stomach underneath, you know, the hands around his neck, the feet around his neck. And then they would bring the camel to drink and his stomach would expand and it would rip your bones apart.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, so when Muhammad Atiyeh and I said this on the Tony Brown's Journal, the phones rang off the hook.
Of course. Yeah.
All right. So then what happens, and this is really, Minister Farrakhan is very upset. Why is Mr. Farrakhan? As in Lewis,
mm-hmm.
Right. Lewis Farrakhan is very upset because, don't forget, his main mission in life is to convince Black Christians that Islam is the path to freedom.
Mm-hmm.
The true path to freedom. Well, if reports are coming out that Muslims are enslaving Blacks, that's going to kind of mess up his gig.
It's a hard sell.
And so he's furious. He's furious. And he goes on a tear. And I had a very, very wonderful Black ally friend in New York, Samuel Cotton, who was a reporter for the City Sun newspaper, which was the number two after the Amsterdam News in those days, was the number two Harlem paper. And Sam wrote a series of articles, and on the front page was one, Arab Masters, Black Slaves. Ooh, in Harlem. Ooh. And the Farrakhaners went berserk, and they started to harass and intimidate Sam. But Sam was a tough guy, did 100 push-ups in the morning, was not afraid. Went to Chicago to say these, to give his stories right in the den of, you know, the Farrakhaners. And eventually, a New York Times reporter asked Farrakhan at a news conference, look, you're denying that there's slavery in Sudan. Even Amnesty International has authenticated there's slavery in Sudan. And I have this on my, you can see Farrakhan's response in mm-hmm. a video mm-hmm. on my website.
Okay.
He says, pointing a finger at the reporters, if you think there's slavery in Sudan, you as reporters should go see it and come back and report it to the American people. Well, unluckily for him, the Baltimore Sun editor sent two reporters to Sudan, and they bought slaves back out of freedom, and they had a 5-page okay. And then Farrakhan fell into silence after that.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that was interesting. So then eventually I've been blessed by meeting incredible people. And the most incredible person I think I ever met is named John Eibner, who runs Christian Solidarity International out of Switzerland. And they figured out a way to bring slaves out of bondage.
Mm-hmm.
And the way they did it was where the Arab North met the Black South. There were certain Arab tribesmen there who wanted peace because they needed the Black Christians to allow them to have to graze their cattle on Christian wetlands, right? So they wanted peace. So we raised money in America and in Europe, free a slave, $50 or $35 mm-hmm. or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And people wanted to do something, and here was something they could do. And so we took that money to the Arab retrievers who went up into the north and found or bought or stole back slaves. And that they would bring these slaves back. And I went to Sudan 3 times illegally because there was a war and Northern Sudan did not want us doing this, but we snuck in through private airplanes. And I went with Christian Solidarity International, who led all of this. And we would be protected by the Southern Black Army. That's another story. The SPLA, Southern People's Liberation Army. We're protected by them in our enclaves. And then we would walk for half a day to a place where the retrievers had brought anywhere from 75 to 300 slaves under a huge tree because it was 105 degrees. And there this was this scene. I can never forget this. These days were the most wonderful and shocking and emotional. And if I start to tear up here, it's like, so you go and you see the scene of these women and children, very few men. Like I said, they killed the men. And if they took men, boys, I mean, when the boy got to be, you know, adolescent, they'd slit his throat because they could be dangerous, right, to them. And you'd see the scene of women and children, and we would go to them, and through, these were Dinka people. The Dinka people are, it's a tribe in South Sudan that is very, very, very tall and very, very, very ebony, black. Beautiful, absolutely gorgeous people. Manute Bol is a famous one in America. He's a basketball player. Anybody who knows basketball will know him. He was like 7'3". I once tried to get into a taxi cab with him. It was not possible. Through a Dinka translator, Eibner stands up in front of these people and he says, God loves you. He's arranged for us to raise money to free you. Anything that you did as a slave is not a shame. You should not be ashamed, you know, because they raped them, they whatever. It was. Now you're free. And now, since the villagers, they were going to be free to go back to their villages in the south. And since this was known was going to happen, many of their family members had come to this liberation ceremony. This act of liberation. And once he said those words and the Dinka guy translated them, there was like whooping and hollering and like you've never seen, and happiness. It was just, so I actually got to witness, I'm blessed, I got to witness many times this happening. And I have a book coming out about it, but other people have written about it. It's just the most amazing thing. So we did that. Eventually, George Bush, President, the second one, George Bush, found out through his church that this was going on. And he forced Khartoum in the north, the Arab Muslims in the north, to allow the people in the south to have a plebiscite, to have a vote, whether they wanted to stay in Sudan or whether they wanted to secede and make their own South Sudanese country. And 99.99.99.99 voted to secede. And in, I think, 2005, was it? South Sudan is the world's newest nation. And that was because of, mostly, I think, because of what we did, because we, the issue of slavery, because, you know, I used to have these debates with some of the South Sudanese who would say, we can't talk about slavery. They're killing us. Killing us is worse than enslaving us. And I said, that's true logically. Logically, that's true. But Americans have heard an awful lot about wars in Africa. There is compassion fatigue, as that was the word of the day. But America is a country that tore itself apart over the issue of one man owning another. If you explain to them the enslavement of blacks, America won't stand for it. That's what happened. So South Sudan became the world's newest country. And sadly, because all African countries are made of many tribes, these tribes, which had united to defeat the jihad, once the jihad was defeated, they fell into conflict.
No common enemy. Conflict. Yeah.
Sad, sad thing. But at least they're free. So that's how did we get to this?
We started with your life, where your life began. Alrighty. So when it comes to freeing the slaves, it's not something where you have to go. It's just a matter of raising the money. Is that really how you free slaves? You don't have to go in and like rescue people. This isn't like that. Who's the guy? The movie that they just made. Sound of Freedom. It's not like that kind of thing where you have to go in the night and grab bodies. You just pay. You just raise the money.
It's not like what the Israeli army is doing right now.
Mm-hmm.
Just did the other day. It's not like that.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have people who will... it's not in the middle of... They're outside the war area.
Mm-hmm.
And you're getting... And they're already acting as slaves to in households. And so we collected money and we paid. We had to arrange for, well, Eibner did that, arrange mm-hmm. for the Arab retrievers to go, to be paid to do this work.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. It was not a search and destroy. It was not a right. armed.
No. It's never that. Okay. Is that generally the case? So actually, can you paint a picture for slavery kind of on the world stage? Because I think if you talk to most people on the street, they're going to say, oh yeah, slavery, we know slavery still exists all over the world. And they're really just thinking of kind of like underground sex trafficking. That's what they're thinking of. They're not thinking of any kind of anything else really when it comes to slavery. And because of that, they're sort of thinking, well, there's that in America, right? There's people who get trafficked through America. Slavery hits every continent basically, or every corner of the world where there's people. But you're focused on a certain, or maybe you're not, are you focused on just this slavery that's happening in these African countries by Arab abusers? Are there different, I don't, for lack, genres, flavors, types of slavery all over?
Right. You have your finger on an important question, and that is, yes, there's many kinds of slavery. First of all, the first thing to say is, every civilization had slaves, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Muslims had slaves, Christians had slaves, Jews had slaves, Chinese had slaves, the Roman Empire was built on slaves, Greek had, so there's nobody who's like Mr. Slaver, which is,
yeah.
Everybody has to know that, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so there's that. In the modern world, there are many kinds of slavery, some of which are hangovers, like there's debt bondage still. So if you're in Pakistan or India and you're a poor farmer 10 generations back and you had a bad crop and you were an independent farmer and you needed to feed your family or they would die, or you needed medicine for your wife or she would die, you would go to the landlord and you would say, I want to sell myself and my family as laborers. It's called debt bondage.
Mm-hmm.
You take care of me. You pay my debt that I had to incur for feeding my family. And I'm going to be your temporary slave. Well, since they were illiterate and innumerate, and since the landowner never paid them for what he said he was going to pay them and never counted the bales of whatever or the bricks, never counted the bricks right, never gave them a fair accounting of their work, or charged them for their tools and put interest on it, they never escaped the situation of being debt bonded. So you could be born today as a debt bonded slave because your great, 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 great grandfather had a bad season.
And that happens a lot?
That happens a lot.
Mm-hmm.
That happens. Yeah. Go Google debt bondage and it's true. There's slavery in India. You know, we American middle-class people have a lot of Oriental rugs and a lot of Asian rugs on our floors, on our very nice floors.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a lot of those are made by child slaves mm-hmm. who get stolen from their villages. Or often what happens is that slave trackers go into these poor Thai villages and they say, or Laos even, all over Asia. And if the people the woman has 10 kids and she can hardly feed them. And the slave guy says, well, I'm going to give your son or your daughter a job and they'll send back money so you could feed the rest of your kids. And sometimes it kind of happens that way. So the woman knows I know somebody and they are sending back money. So they send the kid off and the kid winds up in a brothel or winds up in a rug manufacturer, a carpet weaving place
mm-hmm.
where from dawn to dusk, from toddlerhood to adolescence, they're sitting there weaving because they like their small little hands to make these little knots that they got to do. And God forbid you should cut yourself and bleed on the rug because then the master would come and cauterize the wound with a candle lit, you know. And okay, and then there used to be a big traffic in little Asian slaves to camel racing in the Gulf. Camel racing is like football in America. It's like a big, big deal. Stadiums, huge number, amount of money being bet, wagered. And they wanted these little kids to be the camel jockeys because they're lightweight, right? But if a camel threw a little kid off, that's the end of the little kid, because if he breaks a bone, nobody's going to fix it, and he's going to be a beggar or, for his whole life. And so this happened. In that one, there's a nice ending. They got robots instead of camel driver. They got robots instead of slaves. That is one kind of a cute, nice ending where modern technology saves slaves. There's also sex trafficking all over the world, and it's true. And it's true, and it happens in every society, every culture, because you know why? Because human beings ain't so good.
Right. Right. Us religious folk understand that.
That's right. I mean, especially if you don't have religion, human beings are born not so good. You know, as my tradition, the Jewish tradition, says you have a bad side and a good side. And you better know you have that bad side. And sometimes that bad side can do good because it's, you know, like the libido is good because it makes you ambitious and, you know, competitive and all that. But if it's not channeled into the good that the Torah teaches you what is good, you're going to be an evil person. So it's the opposite of modern scholarship, modern philosophy that says, you know, man is born free and good and society ruins him, right? So anyway, to get to your question, yes, there are all these kinds of slaveries. And you know what? There are organizations that help those slaves. There are lots of good human rights organizations. There's one for the camel driver. There's one for the weavers. There's one for debt bondage. There's one for Pakistani debt bonded people who have to do brick making, like the Jews did in Egypt. There's in Brazil, there are people who free slaves from having to chop down the Amazon forest and make charcoal. There's all, everybody's for the only one that doesn't have an organization for them, really, because it's politically incorrect, is the black chattel slaves of Africa because of the fear of Islamophobia, right? If the evildoers are not white Westerners, the human rights community doesn't care.
What about these groups that support, that try to help slaves in Asia? Those, because it's they're different religious. I don't know. Are they Buddhist? Are they? I don't know what they are. Are they Hindu? And that. And so there's just
But they're slaves not because a certain ideology says it's, you know, it's okay to enslave them. They're slaves because rich people do bad stuff to poor people, more or less. More or less. There are people who make an argument that there's certain parts of Buddhism that allows slavery, that makes Buddhism not so deliciously wonderful as everybody will tell you. But Islam has this jihad problem that is that you're allowed to enslave non-Muslims who resist being converted to Islam, or who are Jews and Christians who are allowed to be Jews and Christians, but as long as they agree to be subjugated to Muslim overlords. Not slavery, but it's overlords. So if you say, if you want to know what the human rights community is going to prioritize, you don't find out that answer to that by finding out the worst things that people do to each other. That should be, right? I mean, if you're going to be in the human rights world and you want to, you know, save humanity from the worst things that could happen to it, you would say that's how we should prioritize. Whatever is the worst thing that happened, let's go fix that.
Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm.
That's not what they do. That's not what they do. Because they're not interested in human rights. Because, and here's, this is the most controversial thing I learned from this 25 years in this business. People who belong to Amnesty International or Human Rights Watch, there are mostly, you know, good, decent, white, middle-class people. And what motivates them is they want to be relieved of white guilt. And so when you see apartheid in South Africa, it excites them to say, I am not a bad white guy. You see, I'm fighting apartheid in South Africa. That means that I'm not like all the bad white people in the world that I know that are there because I've been taught by who knows how many people that white people are bad or that America's mm-hmm. bad, or that imperialism or colonialism, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. But if you tell them that Arabs have black slaves, they don't want to know. That distracts them. They're not going to get any points for being a good white guy. That distracts them from what they're in that for.
Mm-hmm.
So the human rights thing is, to me, a fraud. It's not about human rights. It's about expiation, exculpation, of getting rid of white guilt. So they want to be, show you, it's virtue signaling, right? They want to show you how good they are by either criticizing white behavior, scolding white behavior, damning white behavior, and therefore, look at me, I'm the good white guy. So this is a sin. It's a sin because it abandons victims of non-white oppressors, right? And I have a whole category. I mean, it abandons women under Islam, right? It abandons mm-hmm. Christians under Islam. It abandons blacks under Islam. Or it abandons anybody who's oppressed by non-Westerners.
So it's going to take basically Africans or Black Americans forming their own humanitarian groups in order to fight this, really, because you're saying those other, the ones that are sort of the old guard.
Well, I was talking about the human rights leadership. I mean, when we had the American Anti-Slavery Group, we had plenty of white kids who understood to do the good thing. They didn't care who was doing it. They just had to free black slaves, and that was it. But the leadership was not, they, oh my gosh, no way.
So if people want to basically, I guess, assist you in your cause, the best thing they can do is give it to folks who are going to raise the money to go buy these people's freedom, or like what kind of government pressures can be had? Like, right. isn't slavery technically like illegal in Mauritania, but it's not enforced.
Yeah, they made it illegal a lot of times, but it doesn't matter. I mean, it just doesn't matter. So it depends on each country. So there's no more buying back slaves big thing that can happen in Sudan because the war is over. There are still 20,000-30,000 slaves in the north. There are people secretly trying to get them out, but that can't be, that's got to not be talked about so much because they can get them out quietly. Mauritania, my God, whoever. I mean, you know who could free all the slaves in Mauritania in one half a paragraph? Louis Farrakhan. He could say, free my black Muslim brothers and sisters. Right? But he's not going to do that. Mauritania and the same thing is happening in Darfur, which is northwestern Sudan, where these African Muslim people who refuse to be Arabized and Islamized, but who want to maintain their own culture, but even, you know, who in some sense are still Muslim, they're looked down upon by the Muslims who don't, you know, who think they're the real Muslims. So that's, I think, the way to do it, since we don't have a way that we used in Sudan to go retrieve slaves in a wartime, you know, taken war. Is to put pressure on the American government. Nigeria, I'm working with the, you know, as I said, I'm Jewish. October 7th comes and people stormed into Jewish villages they killed, they murdered, they raped, they burned, they tortured, and they stole people into captivity. And people were saying, well, it's like the Holocaust, because never since the Holocaust has there been so many Jews killed in one day. That's true. But it's not like the Holocaust at all, because it was done, the Holocaust was done in secret. The Germans hid this from people. They didn't go in there with GoPro cameras and
stream it live.
They did not do that. And they also, at the end of what they were doing, in the beginning, it was kind of like personal, like they shot individual. They did it wholesale and almost like in a clean manufacturing way. They took a bunch of Jews, they put them in a box, they put gas in it. They took the bodies, they burned the bodies, and that was it, right? That's not what happened to the Jews on October 7th, because on October 7th, these guys were with knives and individual horror, and they went with GoPro cameras and they showed the world, okay? Mm-hmm. So what is the proper analog to what happened to the Jews on October 7th? It's what's happening in Nigeria today. Nigerian Christian communities are being October 7th
every week.
Mm-hmm. Because in the Middle Belt, where Islam meets Christianity, the two communities come together. Muslim radicals of Boko Haram are raiding African villages and are doing the same. They don't have GoPro cameras, but they're doing the same thing. They're raping, they're torturing, they're burning people alive, and they're stealing people. And they're stealing them and taking them away. And your listeners might remember that Michelle Obama got upset about this once.
Bring back our girls.
Mm-hmm. Hashtag bring back our girls. Well, that was good for about 2 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
Then she left that off. And I don't know. Why would she have left that off? The girls still need to be brought back. You know, they're not.
Still to this day, right? Like.
I think she might have had a word with Louis Farrakhan, or I think they brought back a lot of the Muslim girls they mistakenly took, and they kept the Christian ones.
Mm.
So I don't know, I don't know, but it's a sin that she let that off. But I mean, so people know that this is happening, right? Because Michelle Obama told you, and it was. Popular to was famous.
Everybody had that hashtag. Everyone. Mm-hmm. For 5 minutes, like you said.
So I am working with the Nigerian American community and the South Sudanese community. I intend to build a kind of a African Jewish alliance.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working with a group called ICON, International Committee on Nigeria. I went to Washington with Dumasani Washington, who you know.
Yep, friend of FBT, yep.
And he's a partner of mine. I love him. We went to Washington to be in a conference of the Nigerian American community. And we are planning to work together to form a new movement to free Nigerian slaves. And we will be joined by others, South Sudanese and Darfuris and others who are oppressed by this radical Islamist ideology, maybe even Iranian women, maybe even, I don't know, Pakistani Christians. But anyway, right now we're going to focus on the Nigerian Christian community. And so I helped get published. The head of ICON is called Stephen Enada, who you should have on your show. He's brilliant. He's a Nigerian-American. And we got his article into Newsweek magazine, and it made a big splash. And we're organizing people and pastors. And one interesting thing about the Nigerian-American community is that they're extraordinarily successful. They're doctors,
right,
they're lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody said there's a urban myth that they have the highest SAT scores in the country. Could be true.
I think they're the most educated minority in the country. They're not necessarily the highest earning. They're up there, but they're the most educated. Most PhDs. Right. Yeah, that kind of thing. Yep.
Right. So they need to be organized. And, you know, many of them are afraid to speak out because they have family in Nigeria and the Nigerian, you know. So, you know, Hamas is Boko Haram. Boko Haram is Hamas. Mm-hmm. It's the same ideology in different places that says that we can dominate you and subjugate you.
Mm-hmm. Do you have alliances or people working with you that are Muslim Americans or immigrants or whatever that aren't these radical jihadists that come alongside you and help fight these causes, or is it mainly just Jews and Christians?
I have on my board of one of the organizations that I run is Sheikh Mansour. He's a reformist Muslim. And I'm very friendly and have worked along with Zudi Jasser, who's a Muslim reform person. Mm-hmm. I forget the name of his organization. He's running for Congress now. He's a wonderful guy. There are Muslims who are also maltreated, and they will be, you know, the Mauritanians are Muslim. Mm-hmm, they will come with us. So, yeah.
Okay, so you have, but it's, are the Muslim allies that you have typically like of African descent, or do you have Arab,
yes.
Are these guys Arab as well? Because you're saying names, but I don't know.
Yeah, no. Well, the two that I, Zudi Jasser is not an Arab. I'm not sure what he is, but he's not an Arab.
Okay.
He's not an African.
Okay.
Sheikh Mansour is not an African.
Okay.
It'd be very, very dangerous for Muslims to, for their own sake, to be involved in this because it is dangerous.
You get put on a list, right? And then who knows what will happen to you next.
Or worse. Right. Or worse.
So the type of slavery like in Mauritania is more like it, or maybe that was only in Sudan. In Mauritania, is it more like American style slavery where it is labor workers, or is it just we keep the girls and they're basically our sex slaves?
No, they have the men and the women there, and it is labor, but it's not plantation labor. It's domestic labor, small farms, keep the house up, take care of the goats, like that, agricultural.
I think that is just so compelling because, like I said, I think a lot of people brush off modern day slavery as kind of sex trafficking, and that's, we can try to fight it and we should, but it's a certain type of evil that's always going to exist, and we should fight it, but what can we really do? But like in Mauritania specifically, and maybe other areas as well, like this is very close to American style slavery, right? Like, basically part parcel the same.
Chattel slave is a fully owned, like even in sex slavery, when the girls get old, they free them up. They don't, you know, they're no longer useful as sex objects. They let them go, right? No, not in chattel slavery. In chattel slavery, you're there for good. You're the wholly owned property of the person from birth to death. So
does your organization only like basically just focus on the like jihadist slave trade
now,
or
we do because I mean I used to give speeches about debt bondage, and I used to give a lot of speeches about the carpet weaving kids, but other organizations do that, so they don't need
right
me to
you're
do
filling
that.
The gap they, now yeah
I need to, and also the Jewish people and the Black people have been divided recently when we used to be united, and we need to be united again. Mm-hmm. And here is, you know, same enemy, same fight. Hamas is Boko Haram. And this is a wonderful thing for us to do because who else will these slaves look to?
Mm-hmm.
Who else can they look to? You know, the Christian world has not done a great job in protecting the Christians in Africa or in Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And they haven't. So we need to have an abolitionist movement, a movement that, frankly, is unafraid to say the truth about who's doing it to who.
Right. I think a lot of people just don't, and this is your own fault, right? Don't be ignorant, right? Educate yourself. But I think a lot of people just don't fully understand. I think most people, if you said, where's Mauritania? They'd be like, Is that a city in California somewhere?
No. It's the fault of the leftist media, because look, nobody knew where South Africa was either until it got to be bad white guy story, right? So everybody knows where South Africa is. Why shouldn't they know where Mauritania is? It is about the leadership of this country, which has been taken over intellectually by a left wing that has gone crazy, I believe.
Do you or anybody in your organizations kind of do some of that street evangelism? Like, I would love to see what one of these people who's protesting Israel or something, to just walk up to them and show them a video, show them pictures, show them proof, and say, hey, did you know that this is happening? And it's Boko Haram behind it.
You have exactly what I have in mind, but we just started, and we want to do that. We want to have, you ever see these Jumbotron trucks with big signs driving around? So we want to have messages on these Jumbotron trucks into the universities. And we'll think of the message and we'll have images, et cetera, et cetera. And also into Black communities. Because the Blacks, I believe that when Blacks understand this, as they did when I ran the anti, the Sudanese campaign in America, many Blacks will come to help fellow Blacks. I kind of wish I were Black. It'd be easier, wouldn't it?
It's easy to bridge that divide, right?
I mean, what's this Jewish guy coming in here telling me Arabs have Blacks, right? So we'll get there, because we're finding people who want to do this.
And I think things are actually moving in a positive direction, in the sense that everyone is like actually becoming like, not woke in the bad way that it's used today to referring to like critical theory, progressivism, but like what woke was supposed to mean when it originally, was a term used by Black people, like, woke meaning like you're awake to the lies, you're awake to the corruption, you're awake to all those things. And I think the American people of all stripes and backgrounds are realizing that. I mean, trust in the media is at like all-time lows, right? People are kind of open to hearing the truth. And the thing is, when it comes to Israel, like post October 7th, is that everybody's pointing fingers and saying they're lying, it's hard to for people to cipher through the facts when it comes to Israel, I'm speaking of specifically. But in a way, actually, what's going on in a place like Mauritania is a lot more black and white. Like, you have video footage of people being sold for $15, right? I mean, that exists.
We have video footage. CNN did, believe it or not, and it's on my website. CNN has video footage of two black men being auctioned off as slaves in Libya for $400 a piece.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
CNN has that. Right.
Right. Right. So mainstream media is actually showing some of that stuff.
Well, they touch it because it was sensational, but then they let it go. I mean, how can it be that Amnesty International is not leading a fight to liberate black slaves? How can that be? You explain it to me. Why would they not do it, right? Anyway, when you said that people are becoming more educated to the lies, that's what you do. That's your job.
Yeah, right? That's what we're trying to do. That's why we have you on, sir, to try to help that. Oh, my gosh. Okay, so we're at about an hour now, so it's about time to wrap.
Did I talk that whole hour like that? My
goodness. It flies by when it's fascinating, yeah. Interesting, hard-hitting stuff. So let's go to our speed round of questions. And then after that, you can give us your final thoughts. And, you mentioned your book. And so I hope that when you've written that, when it publishes, you can come back on and we can have another hour discussion about what is in there, because I think we could go on and on. And I'm anxious to hear too what our audience says, the feedback we get and the questions that they wish I would have asked and all that kind of good stuff, because obviously you're a wealth of knowledge. But are you ready for your speed round of 10 questions?
I'm a little nervous about it.
Okay. It's not meant to be a gotcha moment at all. There's no right or wrong answers.
This won't hurt, Charles.
You won't hurt. Okay. Question number one, are golfers athletes?
50-50. I don't know.
Two, is it racist to seek out a black person to befriend?
No.
Should we tear down statues of slaveholders?
No.
Should Election Day be made a national holiday?
Yeah.
Who is the most overrated Black intellectual?
Oh, I forget his name. The guy who's running for president.
Oh, Cornel West. Yep. Yeah. Cornel West, what is your favorite city?
Madrid.
What is your favorite movie with a Black lead?
Oh my. Sidney Poitier. What was that movie? I don't remember the
title. To Sir With Love. Guess Who's Coming to Dinner?
No.
They call it Mr. Tibbs.
The Guess Who's Coming to Dinner.
Is Rachel Dolezal a bad person or just misunderstood?
She's crazy.
Who is the most underrated Black intellectual?
There's a new guy coming up and I forget his name. Colin something. Thomas Sowell is the best. Glenn Lowry is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
But there's this new guy who Barry Weiss just had on and I forgot his name, so I'm sorry.
And your final question, is cultural appropriation a good or bad thing?
There's no such thing. Everybody should learn from other cultures and everybody should be other cultures and it's all good. We're all one people. And as long as, sure, it's fine. It's fine. If you want to come and pretend to be Jewish once in a while, it'd be
super. All right. I'm going to hold you to that when I show up at your house for Shabbat. Okay.
You are invited.
Okay.
You'd be an honored guest.
Wonderful.
I'm serious.
Wonderful.
I don't know how I'm going to get you here from Idaho though.
But I'm going to hold you to that. Eventually, I'm going to show up. Okay. Sir, do you have any final thoughts? Anything that you want to plug? Anything that you want to leave our listeners with?
Yeah. I mean, in our time, in our generation, to understand that people are bought and sold and captured and owned is despicable. And the fact that we have to struggle to get people to understand that and to fight to liberate those people is a human good, is something that, why wouldn't we all want to do that? And I'm finding more and more people who want to do that, and I want to be part of that movement. The other thing is that Blacks and Jews need to understand each other the way things really are, and the way things really are that we are just about the most victimized people in the world, and we got to stick together. And that's really an intersectional alliance. That's a true, authentic one. And let's get back to it.
Yeah, absolutely. So if somebody's listening and they want to get involved, maybe donate money, I don't know how they can do that. Can they go to your website? Is there a place where they can reach out?
My website, they can go to iabolish.org, the letter iabolish.org, and they can do it there. Yep.
Okay, great, wonderful. Thank you so much for coming on.
This was great.